For those of you who bought books, we have books out in the lobby. You can snag one after the workshop is over. And then I'm also launching a workbook here, which will be out, I think, in the next few days on Amazon. And basically, it addresses the question in a more kind of narrow and focused way that that gentleman over there asked me, and that was, how do you even unlock your passion and your purpose and these elements of self-awareness? And so the workbook will be specific to that question, and that'll be on Amazon here in a few days. So it's just called the Hackiversity Experimentation Workbook. So, all right, session number two. All right. So for session number two, all I want to do is share three stories from my life. And these three stories, I think, will show how the Lord has moved in my life and hopefully how the Lord can move in your life too. So story number one. This story is about faith and purpose. So as I mentioned, when I was an undergrad, the thing that I really wanted to do is I really wanted to go to Wall Street. And one of the reasons why I wanted to go to Wall Street was, yes, I like stocks, and I like business, and I like investing. I really do like those things. But more than anything else, I just really wanted to be a success. And I thought that that's where successful business guys went. And as I said, I didn't get the opportunity to work on Wall Street. But when I went to law school, there was a round number two opportunity for me to basically go to a Wall Street equivalent. And this second opportunity for me is what's called big law in the legal arena. Now, big law are these prestigious, fancy law firms in downtown cities that pay their associates an obscene amount of money. So many of my classmates who graduated law school at 26 years old went to go work at some of these big law firms and made $160,000, $175,000 a year, right out of graduation as a 26-year-old. And that's what I wanted too. I wanted to make that kind of money. I wanted to make that kind of money not only for the sake of making it, but to be able to do things like buy a BMW and show how people how successful I was because I had a job at a big law firm. But the way big law works is that you need to do extraordinarily well your first semester of law school. That's how you get into the big law ecosystem. And looking back now, I can see it was God's grace, but you know, I didn't really do all that well my first semester of law school. For as good as I did in undergrad, I did not do well my first semester in law school. And so because I didn't, it trashed my opportunity of getting into the big law ecosystem. But being kind of the driven guy that I am, I didn't want to take no for an answer. So, if I couldn't get in the front door, I wanted to kick down the back door into big law. And so what I did one day was I printed out a bunch of resumes, and I went and appeared at these big law firms just out of the blue. And I showed up in their lobby, and I just Googled a partner who was on their website, and I said, hey, I'm here to see, you know, Bob Jones' partner. And they're like, well, do you have an appointment with Bob Jones' partner? I said, no, of course I don't. And they're like, well, you can't see Bob Jones' partner then. But that is how badly I wanted to go to big law. I was even willing to kind of try to go in the back door and do this very unconventional approach. It was kind of like, I don't know if you've ever seen Will Smith in The Pursuit of Happiness, where he just kind of hangs out outside the office buildings. That was me. I was trying to do that. And so I didn't get into big law through the conventional route, and I certainly didn't get into big law through the unconventional route. And as a result, I was feeling really frustrated with how my life was going. So it was the third year of law school, my 3L year, and I kind of woke up, for whatever reason, with this existential crisis. And I wanted to know the answer to a really simple question. And I wanted to know the answer to why. I wanted to know the answer to why I was spending all of this money on tuition. I wanted to know the answer to why am I studying law in the first place. I wanted to know the answer to why am I trying so hard to get a prestigious law firm job. And I even wanted to know, you know, why my life was even important at all. And when I thought about these questions, I mean, they're really simple questions. And they were so foundational to everything I was doing at the time. They were so foundational to me spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. They were so foundational to me being at law school in the first place. And when I took a step back, I really felt like a fool for really not even asking them before. Sure, I had answers at kind of a surface level, but I didn't really have meaningful, satisfactory answers to me. And so I began to look around for a framework. How do you even answer something like that? What is the right framework to do it? And so I pulled a framework that I learned in business school from Toyota. It was developed by Toyota. And what Toyota did was they would ask why 5 times when they encountered a problem. And by doing that, the point was that they could get to the bottom of it. So I engaged in this 5-why exploration. And when I started, I was skipping class, so that's why I start where I do with question number one. Question number one for my 5 whys was, why is class important? And the answer I had was, so I can learn. Question number two, why is learning important? So I can get good grades on my final exam, was the answer I gave. Question number three, why are good grades on my final exam important? My answer was, so I can get a good job. Question number four was, why is getting a good job important? So I can launch a successful career, was my answer. And question number five, why is launching a successful career important? And I didn't really have a good answer for that. I didn't know if it was because it's about me, it's about other people, or it's about my family. You know, again, I had pad answers to these things, but I didn't really have meaningful answers to that question. And so I went around and I looked for another framework as to how to answer this question. And so kind of the two options that I discovered was, you know, I could view this through a secular paradigm or I could view it through a religious paradigm. And so I went to a secular paradigm and I was like, secular paradigm meaning, you know, without any kind of religious or spiritual basis. And when I was looking into this, you know, the big takeaway that I had was the secular paradigm when it concerns purpose really boils down to, in my mind, the circle of life philosophy or, you know, the Lion King. And here's what I mean. So there's a scene in the Lion King where Mufasa is talking to young Simba. And Mufasa says to young Simba, everything you see exists together in a delicate balance. As king, you need to understand to balance and respect all the creatures, from the crawling ant to the leaping antelope. And young Simba responds, but Dad, don't we eat the antelope? And Mufasa says, yes, Simba, but let me explain. When we die, our bodies become the grass, and the antelope eat the grass, and so we are all connected to the great circle of life. When I thought about these implications, it struck me as very odd that my entire purpose for doing what I was doing and living the life that I wanted to lead was just simply so I could pass my genetic code to my kids and my kids' kids, and then simply become fertilizer for them. It seemed to me as being very odd to chalk up what I was doing to the circle of life philosophy. So I ditched kind of the secular paradigm, and you know, I went to a religious one. And no, but where do you even start with that? You know, religions can be really confusing. You know, there's so many of them. They say different things. Some say overlapping things. So where do you even start? Someone could say, well, you should start with Christianity because you were, you know, raised in a Christian household and you live in the West, so it's kind of convenient for you to start there, so why don't you just start there? But I didn't want to just start there out of a matter of convenience. You know, I really wanted some kind of legitimate basis to undergo this exploration that I was. Really what I was looking for was a lead domino, so to speak. Something that, if I could kind of wrap my hands around this lead domino, then I can put everything else into perspective. And here's kind of my distillation of this kind of intellectual exploration. What I discovered was, kind of aside from Christianity, all the founders of the major religions, they more or less say the same thing. They say, you know, I know God, or I met God, or I can help you get to God. But none of them say, I am God. And, you know, there's this crazy place in the Bible, in John 8, where Jesus is talking with the Pharisees, and he says, you know, I am God. He takes on the covenantal name of Yahweh. And, you know, when I was looking at that, I was like, gosh, that is radically different from what all the other founders of the major religions say. And so I hung my hat on that being the lead domino. Because if that was true, if Jesus was who he said he was, then that had to have huge implications for my life. And if he wasn't who he said he was, then, you know, Christianity couldn't be more true or even on the same category with the other religions, because he would just be a liar at that point. So this claim that Jesus makes was really my lead domino in this this exploration that I had, this kind of intellectual exploration. And so really the point of story number one there is that, you know, when I was really looking to root my why, to found my why in something, you know, this gave me the confidence that I could really start here in a legitimate way and start with the Lord and really ask, is he who he said he is? And if that's true, then it had massive implications for my life. And so, you know, I went down this exploration of doing exactly that. And so for you, you know, college is really an opportunity to test whether or not you believe that stuff. And I would encourage you to not wait until the end of college, or even in my case, to the end of law school, to ask the question of why and start your own intellectual exploration about that. And also, I'd encourage you not to be like the millions of other people, probably even billions of other people, who never even bothered to ask that question in the first place. Do it now. And the reason why you should do it now is because it has such profound implications on your life. So, takeaway from story number one is that I found I could legitimately start my exploration and root my why in the Lord. So story number two is about me trying to walk out the lessons that I learned in story number one. So after I graduated law school in 2013, I started to clerk out here for one of the most prestigious judges in all of Virginia. So I was clerking in Loudoun County. His name is Judge Horn. Perhaps some of you know him. But Judge Horn is an awesome person and a great judge, well-respected. And I clerked for him. He's so well-respected that when I was clerking for him, the Supreme Court of Virginia called him up and asked him to chair a committee that was assembled by the Supreme Court to create new laws in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And of course he said yes, and because I was his law clerk, I also had the opportunity to be on the same kind of cutting-edge committee appointed by the Supreme Court of Virginia at a really young age. So Judge Horn and I would go down regularly to Richmond, and you know, we'd rub elbows with the who's who of the legal community in Virginia. And probably by all outward appearances, you know, I had done basically everything expected of me to that point in my life. You know, I'd graduated from high school with honors. I had graduated college with honors. I even got bonus points in this game that we were talking about before by going to law school. I got a real job finally, and it was a really good job by working for someone like Judge Horn. So I had made it, right? But the problem was, for whatever reason, I just didn't really feel all that successful. And so I defaulted to solving that issue by doing what I really always knew what to do, and that was just checking boxes. And you know, I checked all these boxes before, like I said, high school, college, law school, get a job. And I was looking around for the next box to check. And the next box to check I discovered was 40 years away at retirement. That was the next thing that I was kind of supposed to do. You know, retire with dignity, 40 years away, have a lot of money when you reach retirement. And it struck me as something that was very odd, that I would have to wait 40 years to live a life of purpose, to take risks, and to enjoy life only until I got to retirement. It struck me as really odd to do that. But yet I looked around and everyone was kind of living their life that same way. So I didn't really know how to respond. And so what I did was I did something crazy. And, you know, I stopped everything for 2 months and I rode my bicycle 3,167 miles across the southern tier of the United States. That's me. I am on the picture on the left is me in the Atlantic, and the picture on the right is me 58 days later on the beaches of San Diego in the Pacific. And the center picture is my route across the U.S. And so when people often ask me, they say, Kyle, well, why did you ride your bicycle all the way across the U.S.? Like, what really compelled you to do that? And kind of my pad answer to that is I had a quarter-life crisis, but I really didn't have a crisis at all. You know, because in crises, you become apathetic. But I wasn't apathetic. In fact, if anything, I just wanted to make my life more significant. And in life crises, you generally dread the future. But I didn't dread the future at all. I just wanted to make the most of it. And in life crises, you've often found like you've lost your purpose. But I didn't feel like I lost my purpose at all. If anything, I felt like I really never had one. The real reason why I rode my bicycle 58 days and 3,167 miles is because I just really wanted to hear from the Lord. You know, after checking all these boxes and realizing that I'd have to wait 40 years to check another box, I really wanted to hear from Him as to, you know, the big questions in life. God, where do you want me to work? What career do you want me to pursue? And, you know, even who do you want me to marry? I really wanted to figure out what the purpose He had for me was. And so I put a massive amount of time and space between my life back home and where I was on the road on my bicycle. And so the question was, well, Kyle, that sounds kind of awesome. What did the Lord tell you while you were out cycling across America? And the answer is that He actually didn't tell me anything. And it's not because I've never heard from the Lord. It's not because I can't hear, as we'll see here soon. But it's because for me specifically, my personality is very much one of which, if I have a task to do or something, I'll approach it in this kind of box-checking fashion. I'll make it into an idol. And I think the reason why the Lord didn't tell me anything specifically is because He knew that I would do that, and that's not how He works. Instead, really what He wanted from me was to just trust Him and live a life of freedom within these parameters that He set for us and just being rooted in Him and having the trust to live out the life in light of that. And so, but that was specific to me, right? The Lord places a unique call on all of our lives. So for you, He might ask you to go work on Wall Street and make $1 million a year. Or maybe He'll ask you to move to Africa and make $100 a year. Maybe He'll tell you, or maybe He won't tell you. But the point is that He does have a calling for you, and it's your job to run after Him and find it. And if that means you have to do something radical, like ride your bicycle across America, or do something else, then do that thing. And when you do that thing, whatever that is, I can assure you that you will be very misunderstood. When I told people I was riding my bicycle across America, a common refrain was that, Kyle, this is dangerous, and Kyle, you'll probably die, or you might die on your trip. Someone told me that I needed to carry a gun across America, but this is my favorite. Someone told me that I would grow stale in my career if I took 2 months off of work, which tells you everything you need to know about how wrapped up our identity is in this game of checking boxes. Now, despite these objections, riding my bicycle across America turned out to be one of the best things I've ever done with my life. Hardly a day doesn't go by where I don't think about my trip. I met so many awesome people along the way. I got to see America for really what it is, how it's laid out, the beauty of America. And I really got to experience the Lord in really incredible ways. So the point of story number two is that in finding your purpose in Christ, it really takes faith to walk out discovering His call on your life. And things won't make sense, but take risks, keep searching, and most importantly, don't stop looking. Story number three is a story about identity, pain, and joy. So after story number two, you might say, well, Kyle, you know, that's really awesome that you would trust the Lord or just even want to hear from the Lord that you would bicycle across America. And if that's your thought process, I can assure you that you are very much wrong. Because looking back, really what I wanted was I wanted the Lord to tell me what to do, so He would just simply bless whatever it was I was doing, right? It was still this kind of way to have success. But as I said, that's not how the Lord works. He doesn't just set out boxes for us to check or tasks for us to do simply for the sake of doing them. Instead, He's much more worried about our identity. And for a very, very long time, and to a certain extent still today, you know, my identity has been wrapped up in success in general and work in particular. And to show me that, the Lord gave me a test in order to help me relocate it to Him. And so my test came on March 15, 2015. So I don't know if you guys can read that. I'll help you with what's important. So on the upper left, it's a journal entry from my journal. And it's March 15, 2015. That's the date on it. And what it says, I heard from the Lord that, Kyle, from 3 months today, I am going to give you a test. And as part of that test, I had two options. I could, the Lord told me I could either do His work or I could do my own work. And if I decided that I wanted to do my work, that I would end up getting off course. But if I wanted to do His work, that He would protect me in that. But importantly, during this test that I had, He wanted me to take the path that didn't make sense, the path less traveled, and even make a decision that you can't even really rationalize. So kind of being the type A guy that I am, I was like, okay, well, the first thing I need to do is put it in my calendar. So the upper right is me putting this test in my calendar on June 15, 2015. That's my calendar from that date. I have it circled. It says God test. So I had it in my calendar. I was expecting a test on that day. Well, sure enough, on June 15, 2015, exactly 3 months later, I got a job offer from the courthouse where I was working at the time. And you say, well, why do you need a job offer? You're already working there. Well, how clerkships work is they work in one-year increments, one-year contracts. So I was working there, and my contract was up for the second time, and judges came to me and said, Kyle, you know, we really like you. We want you to stay on permanently. So here's a full-time job offer. Enough of this one-year nonsense. Let's get you on board full-time. And so this was the test. It was, you know, do I take this? And I knew that the Lord did not want me to take this. So with a lot of prayer and some really good counsel, you know, I said no. I said that I was not going to take this. But what I was really doing in turning this down was I was turning away job security, I was turning away a paycheck, and I was turning away something that provided a lot of meaning in my life. And perhaps most importantly, what I was doing was I was guaranteeing unemployment. I didn't have a plan B. It wasn't like I had this great job offer in my back pocket aside from this. This was plan A, and there was no plan B. So after I submitted my resignation papers on June 15, I was unemployed. And, you know, how do you explain to someone, you know, what do you do when they ask you, Kyle, what do you do? Well, I don't know, I'm unemployed, you know. Or how do you explain to someone, well, why did you quit your job? I don't know, I really felt like the Lord told me to do that. Like, that's not a good answer for a lot of people. And to compound matters, you know, my job search during this time was really, really difficult. So I sent out hundreds of different resumes, and I got no bites on any of them. I sent out emails trying to tap my network, and I was getting no responses from them. And all the while, I was watching my bank account dwindle down to nothing. So this process lasted 6 months, and I got a job, finally, at a law firm in Fairfax. And I was hired 6 months later. And that job turned out to be the worst job that I have ever had. I hated every second of working there. And I remember asking God, basically every day, it started out as, God, why am I even here? I hate being here. Why do you even have me here? And that question turned into, God, get me out of here. And so I was only there for 6 months. And, you know, here's kind of a testimony as to be careful what you pray for. Because 6 months later, the president of the law firm comes to my office and he says, basically, Kyle, we don't need you anymore. Today is your last day. And, you know, that's really hard hearing that from someone because I had succeeded basically everywhere I'd been before. And so it's like, what? You're letting me go? That was really hard to hear. But not only was that conversation hard to hear, it thrust me back into a position that I was only at 6 months ago. I was back at unemployment for round number two. And I was having the same difficulties as I was having before. I was reaching out to people asking them if they knew of any opportunities. I was trying to network. I was sending out my hundreds of different resumes, and I wasn't getting any traction. And this time is probably even worse than the first time around, because now I had to explain why I was let go from the law firm that I was at for only 6 months. So this process lasted around 10 months. And 10 months later, I was hired in Leesburg at a law firm at Sim Showers, and I really love working there. It's really a great place, and I've been there now for 2.5 years about. But the summary from those two rounds of unemployment was this. In less than a year, I had two different jobs. In less than 2 years, I was unemployed for 16 months. And at one point, my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, looks over at me and she goes, Kyle, you know, you've been unemployed more than you've been employed while we've been dating. Which was true, I was. And the, you know, me turning down this job offer set into motion all these different events that I really could have never foreseen. And probably had I known that it was going to do that, I probably would have said yes. I don't know. But what turning this down allowed me to do was it allowed me to have the time and space available to write Hackiversity, which turned out to be a number one new release on Amazon 8 hours after I launched it. And 8 days after that, it became a number one bestseller on Amazon. What it's also allowed me to do in light of that is it's allowed me to go around and speak to hundreds and maybe even we're at thousands now of different students about how to do college better and why they're doing college wrong in the first place. And really, most importantly, it's really allowed me to experience the Lord at a much deeper level in light of story number three. So in tying these three stories together, here are the big takeaways. You know, in many senses, I'm really still interested in the things that wanted me to go to Wall Street, or the things that drove me to want to go to Wall Street and big law in the first place. You know, I'm still interested in stocks, I'm still interested in business, I'm still interested in law, and I am even still interested in being a success. But what's different is that my why has changed. You know, I don't want to be on Wall Street or in big law simply because I want to show off by driving around a BMW how successful I am. Instead, it's a different why. And I have these exercises that I occasionally do in the morning where, you know, I write out things on an index card and I kind of reflect on them. And one of those things that I do on my index card is I reflect on my purpose statement that I've made for myself. And here's what it is. It's, you know, my life's purpose is to know the Father through His Son, Jesus Christ, and the power of the resurrection, and share in Christ's sufferings, becoming like Him in His death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead and help others do the same. And that's inspired by Philippians 3, 10, and 11. So that was, you know, that has been for several years now my why and my purpose statement that I reflect on regularly. So, in light of those three stories, my question to you, particularly you approaching college or maybe even in college, is, you know, what's your purpose? And what's your why? And what are you going to do about it? So, that's it for session number two. Q&A. Yep. Hi. Yep. You know, I think that depends because there's a lot of variability. And the reason why there's so much variability is because people don't do the things that I was suggesting that they do while they're at college. And so if you don't do those things, if you don't have any kind of internship, say you don't intern until your senior year, I think that your job prospects when you graduate aren't probably going to be that great. If you have multiple internships throughout your college experience and you have, you know, a resume filled up with these different line items, I think you can expect to have a really awesome job when you graduate. So, you know, internships really drive it. Another thing is, what college did you go to that has some effect? Did you go to some of the schools where I think there's a ton of value, or did you not? Another thing is, what did you major in? You know, that has a tremendous amount of influence. So I'm happy afterwards to address your specific question, like given your specific circumstances. But I think the big takeaway is that there is so much variability for college students when they graduate as to what they can expect. And if you don't do the things that I'm recommending, I think you're going to be toward the latter bottom, you know, the bottom half of the distribution. And I think if you do what I am recommending, you'll be toward the upper part of the distribution. Yeah. That's a really good question. So what happens if you really like to do something, or you're passionate about it, but you're not good at it? That's the question. Okay. What happens if you're passionate about it, but you're not good at it? Okay. Well, you know, there's a tension there, because one of the ingredients that a lot of successful people have is they just genuinely love to do it. They're passionate about it. But at the same time, a lot of successful people are really good at what they do. So it depends whether or not, I think, you can develop the skill set to do what it is you love to do. So even if I am really passionate about being an NBA player, you know, I'm not going to be an NBA player. I'm 5'10" and my vertical is not that great, right? But for you, maybe it's something where you can develop a skill set that complements your passion. And so if it's more in the lines of that where you can, I would say go for it. Particularly, you know, you're young, so you have time, and if it doesn't work out, then great, you can always pivot. But if it's something like my MBA example, where it's just, you know, not going to happen, then you need to reevaluate. So what if you're really good at what you do, but you don't really like it? You know, what I've found is that even if people don't from the beginning like what they do, if they're really good at it, they start to enjoy it. And there's something to be said about being really good at what you do. I think people who are really good at what they do, they grow a fondness for that. So I think it's totally possible for your passion to kind of follow you later. Jim, you had a question? Yeah. Yeah, you're totally right. So the question is, Kyle, you said GPAs don't really matter that much if you're in college and you're going to the workplace, but how about if you're in high school and you want to go into college? Do GPAs matter then, right? The answer is they do. So admissions offices really care about GPAs. And so if you're in high school, unfortunately, that means you still have to play under this kind of broken system where GPAs matter. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's a life or death thing. I think that there's a tremendous amount of good options, even for students who aren't in the top of their class. We discussed some of those options as to where I think they could go and get tremendous value. So the fact that you don't maybe have a Sterling GPA isn't the worst thing ever. But yes, GPAs do matter to admissions offices. They matter to undergraduate admissions offices, and for the same reason they matter to graduate admissions offices. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So if you get a scholarship to kind of these private schools that offset the difference that it would take to go to a public school, do you go to the private school still? Is that the question? Sure. So look, someone earlier came and they asked me, you know, if they had a private school that they were really thinking about going to, and it, because of the subsidies and the scholarships that they got, it was almost on balance with some of these public schools in Virginia. And the question was, well, do I go to the private school? And my answer is, you know, on balance, I still think that the in-state state schools, particularly the flagship ones, still offer a lot more value than the kind of private liberal arts schools do. And the reason why is because, number one, employers absolutely love the in-state flagship schools. So it has incredible brand recognition in the job market. And the other thing is that there's incredible network effects. So, you know, people who graduate from Tech, people who graduate from UVA, that is a really passionate alumni network that you are getting into simply by going to these places, much more so than a lot of these private liberal arts schools. So on balance, there still is, I think, a lot of value of going to these public universities. Now, that said, if your particular circumstances are, for whatever reason, I really love this small private school, you know, I really feel like I'm at home here, my family's gone here for five generations or whatever, you know, fine, God bless, go there, you know, but you're trading off some of those things I just mentioned. You know, I'm not going to lose sleep over it because I don't think it's that big of a trade-off. So it just depends how, you know, how valuable those softer things are to you by going to that private, smaller college. Yep. Yeah, good question. So how do you leverage skills during your gap year, so you can kind of parlay them into your college experience? Well, the first question is, do you know what kind of college experience or college trajectory you want to have? And a lot of people who do a gap year, they have no idea. That's why they take a gap year in the first place, to figure that stuff out. So, you know, maybe you enter a gap year and you don't know the answer to those questions. So the sole purpose in your case then, or in that case, would be to figure out what those self-awareness components are. If you do have a sense of what you want to do, then the idea is figuring out how you can take a gap year to then pair your experiences over that gap year with whatever it is you want to do. And, you know, the possibilities for that are really endless, because it really depends on what kind of career you want to have, what kind of trajectory you want to have. And I guess my suggestion would be is, if you kind of know what that is, I would start talking to people in that industry or in that career track to say, hey, look, you know, what's been most valuable to you, and what really matters to the job market here, and try to have them experiences based on what they say. Yep. Yeah, good question. So what questions should students and parents be asking when they're exploring different colleges? I think a lot of the practical questions that we talked about. If I go here, how much money in student loan debt am I going to have to take on? I think that should be the number one question people ask, because that's going to dictate the next 5, 10, 15 years of your life. And then the question is, well, is taking on this amount of debt worth having a college experience here? And some of the questions that you can ask to flesh that out is, you know, can I see myself having a friend group here? Can I see myself living here for 4 or 5 months at a time? Can I see myself working in this general area after I graduate? Because a lot of our jobs come from our network, and a lot of our network is developed in our kind of proximity at college. So, you know, one of the reasons why I'm still here in Northern Virginia is because I developed a network here at law school, and that led to a job here in Northern Virginia after law school. So, you know, if you want to work in Northern Virginia, it rarely makes sense to go to, like, Mississippi for school. So, you know, ask those questions. Can I see myself being here? Can I see myself living here? Can I see myself working here? And how does the debt question factor into all of that? Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I think that I would have, just because, you know, the irony for me is that I never really got to experience debt before and what that meant until I went to college. So I guess in that sense, college did educate me in a way that was unintended. And what debt does, it's super limiting and super restricting. So I would have certainly taken more risks when I was, you know, you could say, well, Kyle, you bicycle across America, that's a pretty big risk. Well, I would have done more of those kinds of things. And not just for personal reasons, even for, you know, professional reasons, I would have taken more risk than what I otherwise did, just because I couldn't with the debt overhang. So I think students really underestimate the option value that they have if they graduate without any debt. You know, if you have no debt when you graduate, you can really do and explore and experiment in really any industry or career path that you want, as long as you keep the lights on, right? And I mean, keeping the lights on doesn't take all that much money to do. But when students strap themselves with 100K, all of a sudden that universe of things that they could otherwise do becomes like two things they can do. And if you don't like those two things, well, too bad, you're doing them because you have to. Yes. Just in life in general? In college in general? No, my parents have been awesome. You know, I've been really blessed by having, like, let's start with just the obvious stuff. Like, my parents are still married, and that's been a huge blessing, just stability-wise. You know, they've always been really supportive of what I've done, so I think that's kind of given me maybe the courage and the boldness to do some of these things. So I would just say, you know, be supportive, but also be proactive in helping your students figure this out. And, you know, be empathetic. Like, the cost and the reality that 18-year-olds face today are just fundamentally different than the cost and the reality that you guys faced when you were 18 years old. And I think what a lot of parents do is they say, well, this was how it worked in my day. This is how it still works. And it's like, no, it doesn't. Things have fundamentally changed. And I don't think that people realize the extent to which things have fundamentally changed. I think we're still operating as if it's just business as usual 30 years ago. And when we do that, we trap people in this kind of conventional wisdom, three-step approach that I indicated earlier, and it causes real harm to real people. So, get with the times, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, I think they're awesome. So what do I think about trade schools? No, I think they're really amazing. If you can get, well, let me take Nova, for example. You know, I talk to people at Nova, and, you know, we're in dialogue. No, they have a program there where you can enroll and you get trained in working in these, you know, data centers that we have all over the county, and you make $80,000 a year. I mean, it's insane. But yet no one wants to do that because no one wants to go to Nova. It's like, I'll take Nova and an 80K salary a year versus graduating with a major in basket weaving from a four-year university. I mean, it's crazy to me that so many people, just purely because of the stigma, want to go major in a worthless degree from a four-year institution, spend 4 years there, $100,000, and set themselves up for a life of debt and just discontentment. It makes no sense to me, and it's purely based on the stigma. And so I would say buck the stigma and do what makes sense for you. So, no, that's a really good question. So, you know, what you mean is, you know, what if I want to do something that, let me frame it like this. If you like basket weaving, I like baskets, and I want you to explore something that's related to basket weaving. But in order to do that, you don't need to go to a university and spend 4 years and get in $100,000 to go do basket weaving. You don't need, in that example, we treat university as a plan B. And we live in a world right now where there's virtually no gatekeepers to doing whatever it is you want to do. So if you want to go do basket weaving, just go do that thing, right? You don't need a plan B in the form of college and get into all this debt. Just go do the thing that you like. And if, you know, you later discover that for whatever reason your basket weaving career needs a credential in the form of a college diploma, you can always go back to college.